This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tong fever has reached epidemic proportions in Stanford. Chris Murphy wants us to go slow on Syria. And I'd read up more about possible military intervention, but the New York Times website just got hacked by the Syrian Electronic Army. These are just a few of the stories we'll be tackling today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can also email wherelive at wnpr.org or tweet us at wherelive. The cameras of CTN are here as well today. I want to welcome in our guest. Matt Kaufman is an investigative reporter, staff writer for the Hartford Current. Good to see you again, Matt.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Colin McEnroe, of course, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR and now a regular contributor to The Wheelhouse. How does it feel, Colin?
I'm very excited, especially the huge addition to my paycheck.
Yes, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Let's start, though, with the big story from yesterday. Another chapter in the downfall of Chris Donovan's congressional campaign came to a close yesterday. Robert Braddock Jr. sentenced to 38 months in federal prison for his role in a bribery scheme involving Donovan and a roll-your-own cigarette bill. He gets 38 months, Colin. The judge essentially does a couple things here. Cites his work with the Florida-based nonprofit group, says he's been doing a lot of good work during this phase, but also wants to send a message about corruption in government. Does this sentence send a message, do you think?
You know, I think it does send a message. I mean, it sends several messages. One message that it sends is don't go to trial. He's obviously paying what they call the trial tax. And, you know, I feel like that's sort of an inversion of the public good in some ways. I mean, I understand the way the world works. I get it. But, you know, trials like this one actually do perform a service in terms of really bringing forward details that you don't get. You know, when other corrupt public officials plead out, I mean, a la John Rowland, you never really get the entire story, whereas you come closer in a trial like Braddock. So I feel like he should get a little medal for going to trial instead of being punished for it. So, I mean, and that's the first message it sends. And, you know, it is a pretty stiff sentence. It's below the guidelines. She dipped below the guidelines, as you said, because he's hauling crates of oranges around down in Florida or something. But it's still, you know, that's some serious time. I do think the last thing I would say about Braddock is, you know, he, in terms of what his comments were, I think this was the wrong time to start channeling Whitey Bulger or Jack Nicholson as Frank Costello or something and start yelling about rats. At least I'm not a rat. I didn't wear a wire. Like, you know, I mean, don't say that. All right, it's the wrong time to say that.
And that's the thing, that Matt, this quote, they asked me to wear a wire, much like Ray Soucy did and John Nassy, who became Josh Nassy, who became a rat as well. And I refuse to do that because that's not what we do. That's not what we do. This honor amongst thieves. Now all of a sudden he's part of this mafioso.
Exactly. Weird. So he said that's not what we do, and I'm proud of that. And I had the same reaction you did. Who exactly is the we that he's talking about? And I found that really disheartening as someone who sort of, you know, favors good government, that there seemed to be the sense of people who do what I do, and what he does is run political campaigns, don't do that. You're not going to find people doing what I do exposing violations of federal law. Is that really something to be proud of? I found that maybe he had been silent for so long that it just all came bursting out, but a curious and to me sort of disheartening statement, and just the brazenness of the conspiracy was sort of fascinating. I mean, I know I've been in this business a long time; I should be beyond this, but how comfortable everyone was with it, how many people knew about it, and nobody said, we are not getting anywhere near this. Stop this right now! It just didn't happen.
And it's also in the latest in this string of political scandals in Connecticut that involve not that much money. It's not as though millions of dollars have been funneled. We're talking a couple tens of thousands of dollars worth of campaign money that probably could have been funneled some other way much more cleanly.
It is always astonishing of those small minority, I think, of politicians who are for sale, how low the price can be. Now, again, I'm not saying Donovan was for sale, but there were people involved in politics who were willing to trade favors for what seemed like relatively small amounts of campaign cash.
Although I think it's also important to look at the other side, too. And, you know, at some point, it would be interesting to assign a numerical value to the tax abatement that they were basically seeking.
Yes.
Okay, so we know what it costs to buy your way into the legislature. It's 27-5 in this occasion. But what's the number on the other side? That number might be a much – I don't happen to know how big the roll your own industry is. But that might, number might be a substantially larger number. And in some ways, that's the number we should care about more. It's what they're buying. What are they buying for their 27-5? How much money are they getting back?
Well, when Matt talks about this idea of, you know, who is the we? Is we everyone who gets into politics? We're going to have each other's back. We're not going to be rats. One thing that I think we got out of yesterday, though, too, Braddock says, you couldn't force me to work in politics ever again. If the judge really wanted to make it worse, she could have sentenced me to work for another campaign. That's a great quote, though.
Yeah, I don't think his cell phone is blowing up right now with offers anyway. But, you know, I mean, just back to what Matt said about the brazenness about of this, you know, and the way that so many people who are not named co-conspirators seem to know about it and have a comfort level with it. This is occasion absolutely zero soul-searching on the part of the General Assembly. And that, to me, is the real crime about this. Brendan Sharkey called it a distraction. Their reaction about this is to do nothing, to proceed as if nothing objectionable or noxious happened. And I think we all know better.
Because a guy, at the end of the day, a guy who's not from around here, who's not part of the political culture here, ends up going to trial, going to jail. Everyone who has been around here for a while gets Matt to just sort of say, okay, we're done with that for now.
Well, I fear that may be the reaction. I mean, we sort of have these cycles of corruption in Connecticut, and I felt like we were in like a relatively calm period, and this sort of, you know, filled that vacuum. But Colin's right. I mean, the General Assembly could have said, we need to be front and center here and need to clearly put out the message to our constituencies, to the people who employ us, that we will not stand for this, that this is what we don't do, and, you know, we're proud of that. Not a huge rush to let's really have just best in the nation campaign finance reform and just get the word out there. Campaign contributions are not the way to buy, you know, that sort of direct access to affecting legislation. We didn't see that.
We're in the wheelhouse today. We're talking with Matt Coffin from the Hartford Courant and Colin McEnroe, and we're going through the week's news. I want to bring in Kate King, who's a staff writer for the Stanford Advocate, where she covers government and politics, to talk about a series of stories in the Hearst newspapers this past week about a contractor who is a good friend of Governor Malloy, who calls him Danny. I don't think a whole lot of people get to call him Danny. Kate King, welcome to our show, first of all.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No problem. So who is Al Barbarotta?
Al Barbarotta is a contractor with AFB Construction Management, and he's based in Trumbull, but he has a ton of contracts in Stanford. He manages the city's schools, parks, and buildings.
So how did he first come to your attention in the series of stories that you and your colleagues have been writing?
Well, Al is a familiar presence at a lot of city Board of Finance and Board of Representatives meetings, but we first heard about him on August 17th, which is a Saturday, when the Governor Malloy's neighbors called us and said that a city worker was doing landscaping work at the governor's house. And so we sent a photographer over there, and she saw a city truck leaving the governor's house. So from there, we started looking into why a city worker was doing landscaping work at the governor's house, and that led us to Al Barbarotta, who, it turns out, has been managing the governor's property.
So in a story that you just printed yesterday about some of the reaction from gubernatorial candidates, of course, Republican gubernatorial candidates have been jumping all over this. Somebody who is not in that race anymore, Larry Caffaro, basically jumped to the governor's defense saying, look, if the governor paid for this work, which it seems as though he did, and if the governor has a close friend who's going to help manage his property, what's the big problem? So, Kate, what's the big problem here?
Right, and that's kind of the same reaction I've been hearing in Stanford, and it's pretty much along political lines. Some people say, as long as he pays for the work, it's not a problem, and some people say, it doesn't look right. He should be taking every step to remain as independent as possible from a city contractor who made a lot of money under his tenure as mayor.
So, Colin, first of all, get your reaction. You've been reading this series of stories. What do you make of all this? Are we making too big a deal of a story that maybe isn't a story?
Well, you know, Tolstoy said God is in the details, and I don't think we know all the details yet. I will say this. I thought Malloy had a much bigger problem in 2003. That problem also involved this particular gentleman as well. He was investigated for improvements done to his home by city contractors. As I understand it, one of them was this guy's company. He was cleared by Chris Morano, but that seemed more substantive at the time, and I thought Malloy was sort of lucky to get through that as cleanly as he did. You can make the case that having gotten through that, he should put, you know, just tons of daylight between himself and Barbarotta. But, you know, Kate, one question that I had reading the stories, because it wasn't clear to me, it seems to me that one of the big moments in the story is after Sandy Hook, they need to rehab this school in another town so that the kids from Sandy Hook can go there. And somehow or other, Barbarotta winds up in charge of this, or thinking he's in charge of it, telling subcontractors the invoices go to him, blah, blah, blah. And I guess what isn't clear to me was he getting paid to do that? Or was he just because he's, you know, the governor's, as Chris Healy puts it, the governor's BB Rebozo, because he's the governor's buddy, the governor said, hey, just as a solid for me, can you just go over to this school and make sure this whole thing, you know, works the way we want it to work.
Right. His Al Barbarotta's neighbor has told us that he was not paid for the Newtown work, and that was purely volunteer.
See, I mean, to me, that reduces the way that there's a there, you know? I mean, because one of the things that the governor's office is arguing somewhat persuasively is that Barbarotta kind of falls in this weird demilitarized zone where he's not a state contractor, so he's not there. He's not a state problem. You know, Malloy isn't really in charge at all of Stanford City contracts, so he's kind of not Malloy's problem that way. I mean, it's the whole thing smells a little funny, but you sort of – it's hard – to find exactly what you're going to put your fingers on, although I have one of the greatest investigative reporters in Connecticut journalism history sitting on my immediate left, and he may see things very differently.
Well, Matt?
Well, I'm still reeling from Colin invoking Tolstoy and B.B. Rebozo in the same thought. Look, he's the, you know, chief executive officer of a gigantic corporation called the State of Connecticut and deserves sort of very tight scrutiny. So far, I'm reserving judgment. If everyone is telling the truth, I'm not seeing an enormous amount of there. If indeed this city worker was working on a Saturday when, you know, he's not on the city's dime, that he does work subcontract work, that he's allowed to under their rules, and charged $75 an hour. I mean, you know, more than I make. And so it was not sort of, oh, I'm going to cut, you know, the former mayor a break, and that's going to make sure I keep my job, whatever. If the individual pieces you can hear, I'll someone said Wagner's music is better than it sounds.
Mark Twain said
that. Was it? Okay. That sounds, of course, yeah. And I'm
running that down.
This may be, you know, smells worse than it smells, sort of thing. Individual elements sort of are problematic. There's a city truck involved. You can say, well, this is a, you know, the city employee working at the house. That sounds terrible. And get into the details, again, unless people are lying about how much and who knew what and that sort of thing.
I think part of the smell test around all this is it gets into some of what Larry Caffaro had to say about this. It's this question of, in a small state like ours, where it seems as though everyone knows everybody, and if you've been in politics, everyone is connected in some way, shape, or form. Sometimes you do business with friends. Sometimes your friends do business for you that is completely on the up and up and everyone knows about, and sometimes people like you, Matt Kaufman, have to dig into it and find things that aren't exactly right. But is just doing business with friends, which is part of what Dan Malloy's been doing for years with this guy, is that enough to raise a smell test?
It's certainly enough to raise the question. You know, a lot of this goes to appearances. And again, so far, I mean, I'm not seeing a whole lot of fire in this, but politicians everywhere, and certainly in Connecticut, need to be cognizant of appearances. And this may be a case. And of course, it's not even entirely clear. Certainly Malloy knew that Barbarotta, his buddy, is the person that he paid what actually seems like not all that much money, if he really was getting a 5% commission on work done at the house, to oversee it. But this city employee, it's unclear that Malloy had any idea a city employee was working, you know, on or off his his city time. So again, you are the governor of the state. It is appropriate to raise questions about things, even if they're simply appearances of conflict. I think you need to be very careful in sort of the word choices you make in writing about it, and the sort of the conclusions you jump to, and also be cognizant. You know, we're approaching the silly season, and we're going to get this sort of. I mean, someone was saying this is like some Republican in Stanford. This is sort of classic, the worst corruption you know one can imagine. And this man clearly has no imagination.
Let's go to Sean, who's going from New Haven quickly. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess my thought on it is why would the city or any official allow an employee to use a city vehicle for his own personal gain, basically, you know, charging, as you said, $75 an hour, and the taxpayers are kind of funding half of his business, I would say.
Okay, Kate King, what's the answer to that?
Right, and that's exactly what the city's looking into. It is technically a violation of the city's ethics code to use city property for private work, and I know the Human Resources Department and Stanford's mayor have said that they're investigating this, and they're going to release their conclusions hopefully today.
Now, there's a race for the job that Governor Malloy previously held, the mayor of Stanford. On Monday, Governor Malloy went down to his hometown to finally make an endorsement of State Representative William Tong.
As my lieutenant governor says, he has the potential of being the best mayor in Stanford's history.
Yes, he hits the word potential very hard there, Colin. First of all, your reaction to his endorsement, which took a little longer than we thought it might. Yeah,
I mean, I think that kind of is the only reaction. It's a little bit too little, a little bit too late. He just seemed a lot more interested in the New Haven race than he was in his own city for various reasons. I mean, there are, you know, reasonable explanations for that. But, you know, it's a little odd jumping in after having jumped in so eagerly in New Haven.
Kate King, what are people saying about William Tong and the endorsement of Governor Malloy?
Well, it's pretty big news down here in Stanford since obviously the governor was mayor of Stanford for 14 years, and also because William Tong is not the endorsed Democratic candidate. He's the challenging candidate in the September 10th primary. So the Democratic establishment isn't too happy about the governor coming in and endorsing the candidate they did not choose for the mayoral race. And I think this race will really be a test of how much power Governor Malloy still wields in Stanford politics.
And one of the things we wanted to turn to quickly is that, you know, Michael Fedeli just released a television ad, and it sounds a little bit like William Tong's ads when he ran for Senate. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Mike Fedeli. 55 years ago, my family immigrated to this great city for the opportunities that Stanford provided. My dad was a laborer. My mom worked in a factory.
If we end up with Mike Fedeli, William Tong, it sounds, Kate King, like we've got a lot of these stories about immigrants coming to America to look forward to.
Right, definitely. And it's a great story. William Tong had a very successful, story with his parents immigrating to the United States and getting asylum here from, I think it was President Nixon. And he repeated that message when he was running for Senate, and he mentions it here and when he's running for mayor, too.
Kate King is a staff writer for the Stanford Advocate. She covers government and politics. Thanks so much for joining us, Kate. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back from our break, we'll take more of your phone calls here in the Wheelhouse. We're talking with Colin McEnroe and Matt Kaufman of the Hartford Current. And we're going to take a look at Chris Murphy weighing in on Syria, this big story about ESPN and its investigation into concussions, and the other news from the week. You can join us in the Wheelhouse coming up right after this, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We're joined by Matt Kaufman, an investigative reporter for the Hartford Current, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Well, what's on your show this afternoon at 1, Colin?
Oh, we are actually going to talk about the resurgence of disco, the once reviled musical genre that, you know, famously in Comiskey Park, you know, the records were melted
and blown up
and stuff like that. It's sort of back in all of our music. Electronic dance music kind of ushered it back in, and now it's Robin Thicke and Daft Punk and Justin Timberlake. They're all doing disco songs.
Will you get a chance to talk about Miley Cyrus today? I was hoping so.
We're going to try not to.
Okay, we're going to try not to talk about Miley Cyrus. We're talking about the news of the week here, not including Miley Cyrus. Quickly before we get to Chris Murphy, the thing we didn't get to in the first segment, we have a new candidate for governor. Tony Boucher is running for governor. Colin, what can you say about this?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, she's running as a Republican candidate for governor, and this is the Republicans' idea of diversity, a white woman from Fairfield County. I mean, not that both parties don't have a real problem with this in the state of Connecticut. And here we are on the anniversary of the March on Washington, and we have sort of one significant black politician in the state of Connecticut, and it's the state treasurer, because it's always the state treasurer. And you know, you sort of look at that, and it made me think a little bit more about the coming silly season, as Matt called it. And, you know, are we going to see from either party a slightly more diverse set of offerings? Because really, I mean, Toni Boucher, for them, she's the equivalent of like a lesbian Tiger Woods in a wheelchair or something like that. This is really exciting. She's a woman, and she is actually, she can make another commercial. She was born in Italy, you know. So.
Well, you mentioned this diversity problem. Republicans right now running people who I think all live within about maybe 30 right. miles of one another. It's the strangest thing. It's Fairfield County once again. Well, you talk about a little bit of diversity. Something I wanted to get into with Chris Murphy. He's talking about Siri, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But he also came out and did something that Governor Malloy did. He endorsed Tony Harp in the New Haven mayor's race. Again, we're just a couple of days in front of a Democratic primary. This is not the general race here, and he's endorsing Tony Harp in a primary. Colin, is this what senators do? Do senators make an endorsement in a city primary?
You know, I don't know what senators do in other states. I don't know enough about that. Maybe Matt does. But, you know, in general, our senators have been kind of aloof about this stuff. And not only just our senators, but often some of the congressional delegation will be rather hands-off, not on just local politics, but on state politics as well. They prefer not to get involved. So it is a little unusual to see Murphy charging in there. I mean, as you were pointing out yesterday, he's a first-term senator. He may not have that much to do. That's kind of a little bit of a downtime anyway. But I don't know. I was a little surprised.
Is it surprising to you at all to see that, Matt?
I don't frequently pity politicians, but I pity politicians when it comes time to sort of, you know, stand up in elections that are not their own. There's a certain amount of pressure to, you know, go with the endorsed candidate. As that may not be the candidate they like. There are times that they don't, and then, as in Stamford, sort of irritate their elected officials. So I don't know what the standard is elsewhere, but I always sort of feel bad when a politician, it's not really their fight, but they're expected for the good of the party or to, you know, promote some other political interest that they have of sort of putting themselves out there. So, but the New Haven mayor's race is, I mean, certainly the most fascinating race, so far. So this just adds to the intrigue.
The smart thing to do is say, I don't do that. You know, otherwise you wind up like Malloy. You know, he endorsed Harp. Suddenly he's got endorsed Hong. You know, who knows who he's going to have to endorse.
Well, and I think to me, it's also part of it. And we'll get into the next thing here with Chris Murphy. It's this split between the things that this senator is doing. On one hand, he's endorsing Tony Harp in a New Haven mayor's primary. On the other hand, he's essentially making very impassioned statements going against his own party at talking about Syria. Now, the man that Chris Murphy replaced, we want to go back in time a little bit, and you'll enjoy this, Colin. Former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman has been pushing for U.S. intervention in Syria for more than a few years now. Here he is speaking with Fox's Chris Wallace in March 2011.
If Assad does what Gaddafi was doing, which is to threaten to go house to house and kill anybody who's not on his side, there's a precedent now that the world community has set in Libya, and it's the right one. We're not going to stand by and allow this Assad to slaughter his people like his father did years ago.
So that's then Senator Joe Lieberman talking on Fox back in 2011, being pretty consistent. Now, WNPR's Ray Hardman spoke with Senator Murphy, who again took Lieberman's seat just yesterday, about Syria and U.S. involvement there.
I don't think you can go in here with just one simple surgical strike to punish the Assad regime. They will respond, and we would have to be ready to take step 2 and 3 and 4. That could possibly escalate our engagement to a level that might not be supported by the American public and might not be in our national security interest.
So, Colin, Chris Murphy here saying go slow. What's your take on all this, especially given the fact that we had Joe Lieberman banging the drum about Syria and so many other places for so many years? Now we have Chris Murphy in his place.
Well, Joe Lieberman would arm the Ewoks if he could. and in fact, Joe Lieberman has added his signature today or yesterday to a letter from a prominent group of sort of right-wing politicians, and I mean, Gary Bauer, Elliot Abrams, Leon Wieseltier, Bernard-Henri Levy. I don't think we'd figure out what he's doing. But anyway, they all sent a letter saying, you know, we should do something about Syria. Let's not be afraid to use our missiles. Pow, pow, pow. So, I mean, nothing changes, really. You know, in a situation like this, you kind of like what Murphy's doing. It seems to me that even just for our sanity, the American people should require two things in this situation. One of them is a pretty high standard of proof that we really understand what we're doing here and that this isn't, for example, as I mean, I'm not echoing the comments of the Russian ambassador or anything, but, you know, that this really that Assad really is the person who used the chemical weapons. And, you know, and I think we need a high standard of proof because we've had problems in the past thinking we knew something that we didn't know. That's number one.
And number that has happened in the past.
Yeah, that has happened once in a while. And then the other thing I think we need is congressional approval. Why not just get that once in a while? You know, why not just actually, as a formality, get some congressional approval once in a while? I mean, I think those two are two reasonable things to ask for in this incredibly complicated pottery barn, you break it, you own it kind of situation.
Well, and that's interesting, Matt. Basically, what Chris Murphy is saying is let's just do the things we used to always do. Make sure we have proof of something and get congressional approval. That doesn't sound like it's too far out on
the
limb.
Right. Well, certainly the second of those. I mean, the precedent has been set. Presidents can go to war, real war, without congressional approval, and no president is ever going to, you know, unless he or she is absolutely positive that there's going to be overwhelming congressional support and no lengthy debate and opportunities to sort of undermine him or her. No president is going back to Congress to declare war. So, yeah, there is a certain sanity to Murphy saying, can we go slow here, make sure we know what we're doing, and who knows what the military does indeed know. But there is this curious sort of drumbeat of war that plays out very publicly. You have, you know, and Navy officials say they expect 3 days of bombing, perhaps to begin on Thursday. And I feel like that old SNL skit about, you know, with a keep asking the military, you know, well, what exactly are your troop movement plans? And what information do you think would be most demoralizing to our troops? It's sort of making fun of the media hounding the military for secret information. It's just all out there. And there's just this inevitable feel to it that it's coming, you know, maybe Thursday. If we got some other stuff on our calendar, maybe we'll push it to Friday.
Push it to another day. Yeah. It's a little bit more convenient. We've got another engagement that day. We're in the wheelhouse here talking about the week's news. I'd actually like to have read a little bit more about this morning. I started trying to find some stories about Syria last night in the New York Times. Then again this morning, it seems as though the Syrian Electronic Army, whatever the hell that is, has hacked into the New York Times not just once but a few times over the course of the last few days. What's going on, Matt? This is kind of serious. The New York Times website's down.
Right. Well, the important thing everyone in America needs to remember is the current.com is still up.
I'm sorry.
So,
mark yeah, that down, folks. Yes.
Right. I don't know who the Syrian Electronic Army is, and I don't know exactly. I mean, they do appear to be, you know, aligned with Assad, and that this is not 14-year-olds in mom's basement having fun. But I've always thought. Things that greatly inconvenient the audience that you're reaching are always bizarre ways to get your message across. That I don't think, you know, if someone really wants to read, you know, NewYorkTimes.com, that taking it down is going to win, you know, any supporters to your side. So doing something that just simply pisses off the public at large, it just seems we need to get, like, you know, our public relation friends in here to see, is this a working strategy?
Well, maybe it's a working strategy or not, but I just find it amazing that this has actually happened, Colin. I don't know. I guess I expected that the Times was not going to go down in this way.
Yeah, well, first of all, on behalf of the Naugatuck Electronic Army, I would like to denounce Mr. Kaufman's remarks, but he will pay later this afternoon for what he is for his impudence. But they went actually, I think, against the domain hosting company of the New York Times. I believe that's how they took them down. And this is maybe. I mean, look, this is the era we live in. There's going to be more and more of this kind of stuff. And if you're the New York Times, you're going to have to ask yourself a whole bunch of questions that the Bill Kellers of this world have not typically had to think about in the past. I know he doesn't do that job anymore. But, you know, like, how hardened off is our domain hosting company, Melbourne IT or whatever. Yeah. You know, I mean, because it's not a you can't just be hardened off yourself. Every link on the chain has got to be inspected. So, this is the world we live in, and it really does mean that some penny ante puny bunch of punks can knock you offline for a while.
But of course, maybe it says something about the future of the Washington Post that their new boss is a guy who knows a little bit something about keeping Amazon running each and every day so that we can get our stuff through the mail.
Yeah, and see if if they try that against the Washington Post, see if they get free delivery on their Amazon purchases, Mr. Syrian Electronic Army.
It's going to cost you $7.99.
Right. See if your new John Grisham novel shows up on time.
Now, one of the stories I was trying to access yesterday afternoon in preparation for today's show was the New York Times series on ESPN. But, of course, I haven't been able to read it. But we read a little bit. What have we learned in the last few days about the worldwide leader in sports here, Colin?
Well, a ton. And I mean, what I found interesting yesterday, I have the New York Times delivered to my house in paper form, just for
That's
eventualities.
So charming.
Like this one. I know, it's
so cute.
And I look through my stereo opticon while I'm wearing a hoop skirt, and I read it. So, to me, one of the really interesting things is just the economic challenges that are facing ESPN. Now, ESPN doesn't have a lot of economic challenges, like they have to worry. They're an incredibly profitable company, but. None other than Senator Blumenthal is joined hands with Senator McCain to sponsor a bill that McCain – this is a drum McCain's been beating for a long time, that if you get cable, you shouldn't have to be paying for a lot of stuff you don't want. And one of the things you pay for in your cable bill is the carriage fee that's charged by ESPN, which is a very large fee by the standards of the industry. And so his whole thing, or their whole thing now, is, as a consumer, first of all, you're stuck with this franchise. It's kind of who you have to deal with within, there's a little bit more diversity now, but you're stuck with these people. They shouldn't be charging you for a lot of stuff you don't want. You should be able to get what you want. And, legislatively, that could be a pretty big challenge for ESPN, because I think they were citing, I think it was like 3/4 of the people who get cable don't actually use ESPN. It's kind of like the pool at your health club that you think you're going to use and then you don't, but you pay a lot of money for it. Then down the line, of course, people the age of all the people who work here, they don't get cable anyway, and they're looking to have just what they want delivered to them. So there's going to be a generation coming along that knows how to get most of what it wants without having to buy a cable package that includes ESPN. Another big financial challenge.
Matt, you want to jump in on this?
I'm just saying, the age of all the people that work here, and I'm thinking, I'm seeing a lot of gray right in front of me.
Oh, no, but like
in
all
the mirror,
the people in there.
All the other folks. Yeah. I got rid of cable last year, saving $100 a month, and I just don't watch as much television as I used to.
This may be a be careful what you wish for thing. It's almost like the cell phone companies, that it's this bizarre thing. They end up, here's how much money we need to make. And whatever the rules are, here's how we're going to extract it from our customers. I have a sneaking suspicion if we unbundled cable and I were to go purchase cable under some new paradigm, I'd have 40% of the channels I have now and would be paying exactly the same amount.
Well, that's certainly the cable company's argument. And they cite studies that say that they're – of course, the cable companies are very worried that you might have to pay them more money. They certainly don't want that.
They
say, look, this could happen and we would be sick about it, because that's so like them too. But there are independent studies and government studies that kind of suggest the opposite too. So I don't know. But I also share your – Yeatsian sense, the things that the center does not hold, that things will kind of come unraveled, because that's what they always do.
If any of you are thinking of going to Yale University, I want you to listen to Colin and understand that would be an awesome thing to do.
Now, another part of the story, of course, is ESPN had been working on this collaboration with PBS's Frontline in the series of about concussions in the NFL. We did a show about this. Derek Thompson from The Atlantic was on our show talking about this.
ESPN isn't just reporting on the NFL, they're also business partners with the NFL. And that's a very strange relationship. It's as if the New York Times essentially got, a good deal of its funding from the Treasury Department while it was trying to report on macroeconomic policy. It's not something that most networks, most journalism institutions have to think about, but ESPN does.
So Matt, you're an investigative reporter for a news organization that obviously has other business ties in the community. Talk us through that a little bit, because I'm sure periodically there are some concerns within the building about the work that you're doing, maybe rubbing up against some of the deals that the Tribune Company has.
Yeah, I will tell you, if there's that concern, it's blocked before it ever gets to me. And it was an interesting statement that he had made there, you know, when he said, it's as if the New York Times, and I'm expecting the next thing would be something like, gets a lot of money from New York City hospitals in the form of advertising. Well it does.
It does a lot.
But certainly, in you know, a traditional serious news organization, the money that they get from advertising is never going to sway the coverage that they provide. Now, ESPN is not historically a hard news operation. I mean, they're this vast entertainment operation, and probably looked at something as sort of serious and hard-hitting as that documentary, as maybe a little outside their comfort zone. It may be what's really at stake here, at issue here, is ESPN saying, we're just not ready to be quite that hard-hitting about the areas that we cover in the other parts of our industry.
Well, and part business. Of what they've been doing over the years is they've been trying to, along with everything else, as they eat up the entire world of sports, they've been hiring very good investigative reporters as part of a small investigative unit. I wonder, Matt, if this says something negative about the future of sports investigative journalism, because these two guys who are involved at ESPN have been part of breaking some of the big scandals like Balco, the steroid scandals, the things that have actually really moved the needle in terms of sports. Is this really set back sports journalism in a way?
Yeah, I mean, it might. Well, you know, we'll know the next time either these pair or other sports investigative journalists want to do something and do something on the scope that ESPN can provide. I mean, I have not been entirely satisfied with ESPN's explanation of why they pulled out of the partnership with Frontline. That it, at first it seemed to be sort of an editorial control issue, and it was a big mistake. We didn't realize we didn't get to produce and edit it. And then it sort of came out, John Skipper, the ESPN president, sort of saying, look, I looked at the trailer for it, and I didn't like it. I thought it was sensational. I didn't like the tagline. Frontline is the gold standard in documentary television journalism. I've watched the trailer. It's hard-hitting. And I think it probably reflects exactly what the reporters, the ESPN reporters, found. And nothing from watching that trailer would make me think, whoa, they are way out of bounds here. Let's run. This sounds like ESPN being uncomfortable sort of in that realm.
Well, and of course, everybody on our show the other day was talking about Frontline being beyond reproach, that they're above all this other stuff. You've worked with Frontline on this series that they did after Newtown, so you have a little bit of firsthand experience about working with them. I mean, what can you tell us about that?
I can tell. I mean, I gained an appreciation for why sort of people at the top of the game are at the top of their game. There was just nothing that was, you know, the sky was the limit. And if they wanted to be somewhere or talk to somebody, there was never a sense of, you know what, we can't do that. And it's just they attract people that say, if this is going to help, let's do it. I mean, we flew an entire crew out to Las Vegas, and we were there for 3 days. And they used like 15 seconds of B-roll from it, ultimately. But it's what they wanted to do. They spent 2 hours setting up a two-chair hotel room interview because the lighting guy was just dissatisfied with how it worked. And I'm there, and one of the production assistants is on the phone, or the assistant producers is on the phone with the hotel saying, we're doing an interview here. The chair backs are at a bad height for us. Can we get some? I mean, they and it extended beyond little details like that. I mean, they were absolute perfectionists and take what they do very seriously. And all of those saying they're above reproach, they're the gold standard from my one experience anyway, working with them, absolutely the case.
You were lit extraordinarily well throughout that entire thing.
Thank you.
You looked very nice.
It was the makeup.
Just one quick thing. First of all, this isn't a new problem. I can't remember the title of it because of my concussions, but ESPN years ago did a fictional series about the NFL. You remember this?
Yes.
Yeah, and it really raised a lot of huge moral questions, so they got rid of it immediately.
It was called Playmakers.
Playmakers, yeah. And it dealt with stuff like, you know, guys adding weight and risking diabetes so that they could stay on the defensive line. I mean, it was like incredible stuff, and so they got rid of it. Because really, look, I love NFL football. You love your Pittsburgh Steelers.
I do.
But it's morally indefensible. I mean, it's one of these things that you just love, even though you know that if you thought about it for 2 seconds, it's a morally indefensible world in so many different ways. And that's a little bit different from steroids in any sport, where if you get rid of the steroids, you can still keep the sport. NFL football, there's some real sort of gigantic questions about whether NFL football could still be NFL football if you got rid of all the stuff that's morally abhorrent. And for that reason, I think they're having a bigger problem.
Maybe next week we can talk about how the Packers are going to do this year, though, Colin.
We're going to do awesome.
They're going to do awesome. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by David Panagor, former chief operating officer for the city of Hartford, to talk about something that's been going on in the city for the last few weeks. Now, this little bit of a dust-up between the city of Hartford and UConn about where the UConn downtown campus is going to be. It talks a lot about, well, how the city is going to rebuild itself. We'll be talking about that when we come back in the Wheelhouse next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the CDC says that 300,000 Americans are getting infected with Lyme disease every year. That number is growing. About a tenth of the cases are reported, but many people are being diagnosed who don't actually have the disease. Coming up, we'll dive into the contentious, confusing world of Lyme disease. That's on tomorrow's program. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, joins us as always now. Matt Kaufman is here. He's an investigative reporter for the Hartford Current. We want to bring in David Panagor, a former COO of the city of Hartford, occasional columnist for the Hartford Business Journal. He's been writing about Hartford and its dispute with the University of Connecticut over a new downtown campus. David, good to talk to you.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
So first of all, tell us where we are exactly with this downtown campus. What has UConn essentially decided to do?
UConn's essentially looked at a number of sites in the downtown and made a market-based decision as to where their students would want to be, which is the old Hartford Times building adjacent to the new Front Street development behind City Hall.
And so this new Hartford Times building was one of several possibilities for where a new UConn campus could go. What were the other things that were on the drawing board for people?
There's a series of sites proposed. They did an open request. There was sites. The city originally looked at the area north of 84. There was the old Talcott Garage just south of 84 by M.D. Fox. And there was a couple sites over by Asylum Street.
So when you talk about just north of 84, for people who don't know the city very well, if you've driven through Hartford at all, you know what that is. It's a big wasteland. There's not very much there. It's a series of parking lots. Why didn't UConn want to put a campus right there?
Because my opinion is because it's too – UConn is actually, although a big mover, is actually a small use. And it needs to be surrounded by really strong amenities. And that's what I think that they've signaled by their choice of the Hartford Times. They don't want to be an urban pioneer. They don't – no developer wants to take on too much risk. And UConn, like anybody else, is in a client-based business where they have students that they're trying to attract to go to a school.
But of course, one of the things that I think a lot of people are thinking about on the city level here is, look, Front Street finally, after years and years and years of being just a wasteland with nothing there, now has a few new businesses coming in. There's a movie theater. There's going to be a new Infinity Hall, a few restaurants going in. It's right across the street from a new convention center. It's attached almost, this Hartford Times building, to the Wadsworth Athenaeum, one of the truly great public spaces in all of New England. So you put a school there, all of a sudden you don't have a tax base, all of a sudden you don't have people on the streets. It's just a school that's used some of the time. Is that really the best use of this, David?
Well, the problem with the Hartford Times building, it's really not a problem, but it's going to cost somebody $4 to $6 million off the top just to save the facade and keep the building. There aren't many projects that can afford an extra $4 to $6 million just for the purposes of amenities and historic preservation. So that's one of the reasons why the Nitkin Group, the group that is building Front Street, hasn't moved on that building first. So it's a tough site for anything other than a use that can afford the extra cash.
Colin, what do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think we've said the T word yet, but, you know, I mean, really a lot of this is about taxes, and I think sure the city would like to have a performing property tax-paying entity in that. And, you know, this is now a sweet spot. It's a tenderloin of the development possibilities in Hartford, and they would probably rather have the tax-exempt property being the urban pioneer. And I do feel as though UConn – you know, you use the term market-based. you know, I feel like UConn owes us something other than market-based decisions, that it has to be a significant player in the world of public policy as well, because it is. It's a state entity. It is not a business. And if it wants to act like a business, then it can damn well pay taxes like other businesses. If it doesn't want to act like a business, then maybe it can start thinking about whether it would be valuable to be sitting right next to Capital Community College, emphasizing the partnership, emphasizing the potential transfer of students from one to the other, which is sort of one of the, you know, great things about the community college system right now. It can start being a citizen, or it can start paying property taxes, but it can't refuse to be a good citizen and refuse to pay property taxes.
Colin, I agree with you about the tax base piece, but I disagree that the idea that at its heart it's a public institution that can just shove students willy-nilly where we want them. It has to attract students to go places. I think by their choice, they are stating they're nervous about being able to attract students because they're client-based. We live now in a world where students have choices to which schools they want to go to, and they decide whether they want to go to UConn. And I think that UConn has made the decision that they need amenities, movie theater, infinity hall, restaurants, stuff like that, 15 feet from their door. We've heard from Stanford that it took 5 years to get the students to come out of their buildings. So I think that UConn, right, wrong, or indifferent, has made a market-based decision. And if we think that we can just put students where we like and they're going to show up, I think UConn's telling us that's not the case.
But when UConn decided to move to a downtown campus away from a West Hartford suburban campus, David, they seemed to be doing it with the intention of changing something about downtown, that indeed them putting these students down there was because, even though a lot of students don't want to go downtown, was because they wanted to invigorate the city.
True, but notice what you said. They went from a suburban campus, okay, essentially bucolic, to urban. And there's probably a limit to where they want to go. There's probably some sections of Hartford you might suggest they may not want to locate at all. And there's some sections of West Hartford that are going to be out by the cows.
Matt, what do you see as the role of UConn here? The fact that Colin is essentially saying they got to be a good public citizen, we're paying them, but build a campus where it's going to be best for the city of Hartford, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that as a matter of fact, they don't have to accede to what Colin wants, that they can operate like a business and have a nonprofit status. I mean, the higher education is a business, and we hire smart business people and smart fundraisers to run them, more and more. So if they are getting away with something, they can get away with
it.
And it's
I'm a dreamer.
It's just the way it's going to be. David in his column talks about it's time for both sides going to come together and have some real dialogue about this. And I hope they do. I'm not quite sure what the solution is, unless they sort of go somewhere in the middle, somewhere between, you know, the wasteland and sort of prime property. I will say, I think it's great for the city of Hartford that there is a clearly desirable development area. You know, that there is an area that UConn is eager to go to and is so prized that the city is going, you know what, we'll have plenty of competition for that space. Could you know, you maybe kind of be a pioneer out in this space. I in this case really see both sides of this issue. I understand UConn's reluctance. I understand the city's desire to put, more profitable tax property there.
Well, in just the last minute that we have, David, it sounds like that's the big win for the city. Just that any of us are talking about Front Street as being a desirable location to build anything is something we wouldn't have been saying a couple of years ago.
Absolutely, and I think that the city needs to convince people like UConn or any other business as to why going up near Talcott, why going north of 84 is a great amenity. I think that's the issue, is you've got to convince a developer why to go to someplace risky. And as of yet, that hasn't happened. But I think that the two sides have got to start listening to each other's market-based reasons.
But David, and you've been in this business for a long time, how do you get that to happen? I mean, do we just end up with a wasteland, not just in Hartford, but in all our cities? We know the places where nobody wants to build. How do you actually make the case for a developer? Yes, we want to develop just north of I-84 and make it a real part of the city.
Give them enough land. Then the parcel size north of 84 is large enough for a large-scale development, probably a mixed-use development. You provide enough land with a good visibility to the highway and the best location, you know, on 91 in this region. And I think you can get a development to happen north of 84. Once you do that, everything starts spreading south back onto Main Street. City is 52% tax exempt right now. Is that one parcel going to make the difference? Did everybody believe that UConn was going to be a game changer? No. It's grad students who buy lunch.
Well, we have to leave it there. David Panagor, former COO of the City of Hartford, writes for the Hartford Business Journal. Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks also to Matt Kaufman. He's an investigative reporter, staff writer for the Hartford Current. Good to see you, Matt.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Next time you do this show, Matt, I think I can get you $75 an hour.
At least a mug.
Thanks to Tucker Ives, who produces The Wheelhouse. Thanks also to Heather Brand. And the senior producer of our program is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.